Hey, Roberta. My name's Linnea. I'm nice. It's nice to meet you.
Good to meet you, Linnea.
Good morning. How's everybody doing? Good.
Hanging in there.
Roberta has not burned out yet. That's great.
Hey, Roberta, it's Robin.
Hey, Robin.
Nice to see your face in person after talking on the phone.
Yeah.
Hi, Roberta. I'm Sandra from the BCC office.
Oh, great to meet you.
Kendra is the glue that holds this mess together, so.
Right. Yeah, I think I've been sending you a couple emails and inundating you already, so thank you.
Yeah, anytime. And if I can help you, I'll connect you with someone who can. So feel free to use me as a resource for whatever you need.
Great.
And also, Roberta, this is Doug Munger. Welcome aboard.
Thank you. Good to meet you.
By the way, Roberta, one of the things that you'll have to get used to, although it doesn't change every day, Kendra typically puts up a background that it's your job to guess what television program that's from.
Oh, gosh.
This one I've had up for a little while just because I think it's fitting for right now, but I'll probably change it at the end of the week.
I'm stumped.
So this one, a lot of people have already guessed. This is from The Good Life.
Okay.
Mark, did you make it back or is that just your avatar?
It's my avatar. I have one last truck that unloaded this morning, and then I'm on the road right after our meeting today. It's been as always an experience, but nothing got broken. Everybody's still in one piece. I still have my sanity, so all good.
Very good. So you're actually still in Wyoming right now, huh?
No, actually, Tim, I'm in Arvada. I'm in Arvada, and as I said, it's my other Colorado home, and I'll be on the road after our meetings today.
Great.
You bet.
Morning, Beth.
Good morning. How are you?
Very good. I think that we have everyone assembled that we need for this meeting. So I think we're here to consider extending and amending our standing public health order number 3. Eric, are you going to be the one to present this to us?
Sure.
Tim, don't we usually get updates from public health first, or you want to do this one first?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say too.
I thought I would introduce what's on the agenda and then pass it on to good Dr. Harrington. Good morning. And Roberta. Hi, Roberta. I'm Eric.
Hey, Eric. Good to meet you.
Likewise.
Tim's the boss. Whatever order you want, Tim. That's just usually what we do, I think.
And I love it when people talk to me like that. Good point, commissioners. Why don't we just proceed with an update from public health before we move on to consideration of the amended public health order? Thank you. So Dr. Harrington, Roberta, maybe it would be helpful if Roberta led off with just an introduction of herself to the community. We have a number of people attending today from the community, so this is a great opportunity for you, Roberta, to introduce yourself.
Well, thank you. Thank you, commissioners. And yes, I'm Roberta Smith, and I am day three in the interim role of the Director for Public Health for Rout County. I am a nurse with training. My master's is in public health, and I have certifications in infection control. I'm also an industrial hygienist and have a background in occupational health. I have several years of experience working with CDPHE, which in my first couple of days here has really been helpful to reach out to the people that I need to help get Rout County, stay on track and understand the resources that are available to our county. So this is day three, and I am assisting with all of the case information, getting on track with our data collection, as well as our contact tracing. And then there's the other public health activities that come in as well that I've been assisting with and managing those. And I'm really thrilled to be here and to be a part of Rout County during this time.
Thank you, Roberta. Any quick introductory questions of Roberta before we move on to the actual update? Nope.
None here.
I have no questions. Just want to say thank you, Roberta, and I hope you're finding your first few days manageable. I know it's a big job you're taking on, so thank you very much. We really appreciate it.
Well, you kind of are priority number one here, so, you know, however we need to do that. So again, that's just so you know.
Great.
All right. Dr. Harrington, perhaps you'd like to go ahead and give us a status update where we're at. Hold up, Brian. You brought your Mickey Mouse voice with you today. I don't know what it is about your setup that takes you to Mickey Mouse, but it's a very good imitation. Well,
I'm reading his lips. He said he's going to log off.
Okay, why don't you log off and log back on? That's great.
All yeah. I could, it's really funny. I saw log off and everything else.
Come back with your ears. Well, Roberta, maybe while Dr. Harrington is logging off and logging back on, maybe you can give us just a little bit of a status update of where we're at.
Yeah, absolutely. So this week we have been focusing our attention on the situation that's happening at the Haven out in Hayden. We are receiving results back from those tests that were done last week. And so far we have four residents that are positive and three staff members that are positive. And one of those staff members is a Rout County resident, as well as the four residents. So we still have some outstanding tests that we're waiting for results on, but right now that is the current status that we have at the Haven. We did have a talk with Northwest Colorado Health yesterday. We've made sure that all the case contacts are being followed up on, all the contact tracing. We have also assured that the Haven is taking the appropriate measures in terms of isolation of their residents and the protection of their staff moving forward in terms of adequate PPE and how they're caring for their patients there at the Haven.
I see that Dr. Harrington has rejoined us. Brian, would you like to try again?
Yes, is this any better?
Much better, thank you.
Were you trying to suggest I was Mickey Mousing around? Was that?
No, but the imitation was pretty awesome.
Okay, very well. Well, listen, I'm going to dive into some numbers for you here. And then after that, I think we'll then transition to the ordinance discussion. We are kind of under construction this week in terms of doing some things with our data collection, but Emmy in a minute will show you one of our histograms here. We have had in the past, since our last meeting, only two community cases that were positive, and that's separate and in addition to our Haven cases. So if you look at this histogram, we have a case that, and these are the dates that the tests were obtained. On the 25th, July 22nd is Wednesday, and that is when we did our mass testing over at the Haven, and that followed the two positive results on the 20th. So in terms of the number of cases we've had this past week, I would suggest that it is, if we kind of qualify the Haven cases as a separate entity, our community cases have decreased this week. But I do have to qualify that comment by the fact that we have a continued lag in our test results. The tests that we did on July 22nd, those were all submitted to the state lab at CDPHE. They were done by our public health department. We still don't have all those back. Some of them just came back today. We're 7 days out on some of those test results. In our community, we continue to see a lag with the state lab, LabCorp and Quest. Consistently, the hospital UC Health lab system still runs about 48 to 72 hours, so that consistently has been our most reliable fast turnaround. But this is a problem when our test results still lag. So it's possible we have positive tests from this past week that we do not yet know of. I still, though, view this as a positive indication because we could have had more cases. And we're at the point where I would have expected us to see evidence of a surge if we were going to have impacts from our July 4th weekend when there was some concern about more people and group activities. So, you know, this is a qualified positive message. In the past month, there have been three people hospitalized at our local hospital, at the UC Health Hospital. Two of those do count as Route County admissions. Both were discharged. There was a third individual who had been, who is a Moffitt resident, had been admitted there, was discharged, and then came over to our hospital and was readmitted briefly. Those are the numbers I had to present to you today. Our dashboard is not up to date. There's some work we're doing on that, so I'm not sure we need to go through that today. I can just comment that at the Harvard Institute of Global Health, and if Emmy wants, she can put that up, but the Harvard Institute of Global Health now lists Colorado at a case rate of 9.9 per 100,000 cases, and that's that daily average on a 7-day rolling average. Unfortunately, that puts Colorado right near the 10 case mark, which would put us into the next higher concern category. That just follows the trend that we've seen in Colorado of rising cases overall. Although interestingly, we've not quite matched that in our county, which is good news. And then our case positivity rate, I do not have that calculated because of some work that still needs to be done on collecting the number of tests done in our community. But I would presume with the low number of reported cases that we've had, that our case positivity rate is still quite low. So we're clearly haven't documented an increasing rate of cases, and depending on what the lag in cases feeds into this, maybe we've even seen a downward trend of community spread if you discount the 7 cases and the 5 that are out county attributed from the Haven outbreak. What questions do you have just on our data for this week?
I don't have any questions. Do you, Beth?
Yes, I do just have a quick question. This is just, you know, obviously our statement to the public about a bit of a lag in reporting all of our data has caused some concern. We've gotten comments from various folks about that. And I think that's understandable. People want to know what's happening. They want to understand what's happening. So I guess I wonder if you might just speak to, and I'll just first say for those folks, we understand that that is a problem and it has to do with staffing, and we are working as quickly as we can to resolve that. and set up systems to make sure that that the data is getting out in a timely manner. I guess it would just maybe be helpful for you to talk a little bit about, my understanding is that we still have all of the data we need in order to do what's needed from a public health standpoint. It's really just the public reporting of some of those pieces of data. So if you could maybe just talk about what data we do have, what data is going to be delayed, and how that relates to our actual, you know, public health response. I understand that won't resolve everyone's concerns, but I'm hopeful that that will provide a little bit of reassurance to the community that regardless of what we're able to report publicly at this time, we are on top of what needs to happen. So Brian or Roberta, or both of you, if you want to address that a little bit, I think that would be helpful.
Well, I can start out on this. Roberta, you can tag in too. Mm-hmm. We have several data sources from which we glean our information. One is CDRS, and that's an acronym, CDRS. That is the state data system in which all the cases are logged in. So we have we access that to get our case lists from the state. Our second major data source for us is the CDPHE Lab Online login. And so that is where all of the labs done through the state lab get logged in. Now that won't necessarily be the same as CDRS. CDRS is importing data from all the labs when they report their information. CDRS also contains other information such as antibody test results or positive results, contains probable lists. So they're not exactly the same list. Those are our two state data sources that we rely on for information. Then we have our local sources, and those sources tend to be a little bit more of an email and paper and pencil type thing. We do not have any centralized system that records the number of tests done. That information gathering requires us to contact each of the clinical entities in Route County and actually get them to report to us how many tests that they've done. And that's just a administrative work job. But then we have to do some interpretation with that information. Also, we try to match it up with the results that we're getting in. Combination of these various information sources is not discrete data. So it really is just looking at spreadsheets and lists and cross-tabulating and trying to find where the discrepancies are. A month or two ago, I went through the state lists with us again and Michelle, and we did find some minor issues there. There were names listed a couple extra times that shouldn't have been. One of the areas of conflict can be the assignment of residents. The convention is that cases are listed by the residents, the county of residence for that case. And sometimes there is uncertainty on that. A patient maybe has a legal residence still listed in Boulder, but then lives in Steamboat for a while. We do tend to follow the state's determination on that because at the end of the day, they are the final list. But that is the type of reconciliation work that has to go on periodically to try to understand when we might be off by a day or two. And then looking at this week with the Haven cases. So I just, last night and this morning, was looking at the CDR spreadsheet, which is the state's list. It does not yet contain the names of the positive cases from the Haven. And I don't know why that lag is occurring, although I wonder if it has to do with the overall lag and backlog of things with the state lab. So there's an understandable time lag, and we suffer from that sometimes too in terms of when we get our data and when we put it out. But there are several entities involved in several data sources, and we're not all on the same clock. And that results in this, it requires work just to find the differences and resolve them. I would say that we remain committed to that being critical. We understand that members of our community rely on that information. We know that discrepancies can undermine trust in the data. And so I think it's vitally important that data be accurate. And we do work that, and we're working it this week to try to, you know, get up to speed and make sure that we are reconciled with the state.
It would seem that probably is happening across the state, and I would think in all districts. Mm-hmm. And one would think that maybe at the CDPHE, one would want to institute a program to maybe solve that at the higher level. Then, anyhow, thank you very much.
And I would just suggest, you know, the difference of one or two cases functionally doesn't make a difference for, you know, what we're doing in our decision-making just on a given day. But I certainly understand that perception can be frustrating out there when people are trying to understand why there's different numbers floating around, or if a number goes up and goes down. I mean, no, we're not making these up. It's just we're trying to reflect real-time understanding of the data as we get it and as we figure out and reconcile differences.
And if I could add, commissioners and Dr. Harrington, one thing that is also a priority is when we do get a positive result, it's critical that we get our contact tracers notified and get that process going. So all of that is happening kind of straight away, and that's the priority. And then we add things to the systems that Dr. Harrington had mentioned. But really, first and foremost, we want to make sure those positive cases are being notified, contacted, and we're finding out who their close contacts were so we can make this an effort in our overall virus suppression activities.
Thank you for that. I have a question that's probably directed at Mark, but Brian and Roberta ask you to chime in. For the benefit of our citizens and the folks that are listening in today and watching, Mark, can you describe the staff, current staffing level of public health and where we think we're going to be with staffing levels within the next couple of weeks?
You bet, Tim, happy to do so. With Roberta on board this week, our next most important focus turns to the epidemiologist position, and I will quantify the fact that that's actually entitled epidemiologist data manager. The position announcement has closed. I believe we have a total of 8 applications at this point. We want to make sure that Roberta was on board to be able to comb through those and begin to identify those people we'll hire for that very important position. I believe right now we're trying to set up those interviews really quite frankly as soon as possible. I mean, if we can arrange some by the end of the week, certainly by next week, then that's our plan going forward for that very important and very critical position. We still have 4 contract nurses through Worldwide Nursing that we have retained. Roberta has met those nurses. She's a little more familiar, I think, with what their job roles and duties are. In visiting with Roberta late yesterday, it sounds like one has indicated I can stay a little bit longer, which is good news. But those have been in the queue, and those have been on board for actually several weeks now. We also have, in visiting with Kathy in the HR office, we now have a total of 7 contact tracers that have been hired. Last time I think we visited at some length about this, we had 4, now we have 7. And our goal is to hire a total of 9 for that particular duty and that obligation. The last very important position right now that is being advertised is for our public health nurse. When Michelle resigned and stepped away, that had become our next focus along with the epidemiologist. That is still being advertised at this point, and that'll be our very next most important hire that we've got going forward. And then lastly, just as a full update, Tim, Estella, who is our administrative assistant, is now at 40 hours. She was 25 hours prior to the last couple of weeks when we went into this more elevated mode. She's at 40 hours, and I'll just mention that she's been getting some assistance and some help from Helena in terms of some of the office procedures and protocols, just to make sure that she's a little more comfortable in going through those pieces. So that is the current status of what we have now. The only other thing that I'll add in is, again, we wanted Roberta to have the opportunity to be on the ground, to be able to feel comfortable in terms of where we are now and where we need to go. So we want to have an ongoing conversation with her about where she feels maybe the needs are and the most important priorities, and then we will adjust accordingly.
Thank you, Mark. Any other questions and comments on that? I guess I'd have a question for Roberta. You are obviously very new to the job. Does that staffing level seem to you to be appropriate, at least for the short term, as we deal with this crisis?
It does, and I really think getting that epidemiologist on board is going to help with all of our data integrations and reporting and just getting those systems up to speed. We may have to look at some of our software needs that go with that, you know, some of the statistical software that's needed. But I reviewed the candidates yesterday, and we've got a nice pool of candidates that I have sent to HR, and as Mark had mentioned, we will be lining those up for interviews. So I think that's the most critical piece. The public health nurse piece, you know, that might be a challenge to find someone interested. I've actually sent that announcement out to my networks that I have at the School of Public Health. So hopefully that position will be filled. We also have a health educator position that is out there, and I think that will be an integral part of, you know, some of our PR campaigns and information campaigns. But really, that epidemiologist and that nurse are really those two critical roles that we want to fill.
Thank you. Any questions, comments, Doug?
So I asked this last week, and not to be stupid and not to be insulting or anything either, but can you tell us in a layman's term what an epidemiologist actually does?
Yeah. Sometimes people think it's a dermatologist and they look at skin, but it's not. It's kind of like when I say I'm an industrial hygienist and they think, you know, it's a fancy janitor. But so for an epidemiologist, they really study diseases and how they're spread in a community. It's all collecting data, presenting data in many ways. A lot of people that are in epidemiology have a solid background in statistics. So looking at different variables of information that's provided and presenting that in the various ways. And this is exactly what we are doing to present data to our public and everyone in the county. So a person with this background can really take all of those numbers and manipulate them and, you know, put out the ratios, the rates, and we can really understand better what we're looking at in terms of our COVID pandemic. So yeah, epidemiologists they've always been in the background, and I think they're really being highlighted now during this pandemic for their ability to look at data and translate data accordingly.
So I guess then appropriately, then they also identify risk factors and evaluate and quantify risk factors as well.
Yeah. Absolutely. If that data is available, if we have different variables, you can be looking at, you know, some of the demographics and cross-analyzing some of the data, looking at potentially comorbidities, demographics, any information that we have. But again, you know, with any data, you're always at the mercy of what kind of data you're getting in. So if you have bad data coming in, you're not going to have good quality data coming out. So that is really also, the role of the epidemiologist is to make sure that we are getting quality data that we can do something with.
And I would add that the term epidemiologist gets used a lot. In my sense of it, though, I would use that to somebody who's got experience doing this. So, for example, I have a public health degree, and that involves statistics analysis, stuff like that. But I don't have the experience of working with software and presentations, and certainly not, you know, what a full-time person would have in this field. So I think we'll benefit if we can find the right person who's had experience, can bring some ideas and resources in and contacts. I mean, just like software, you know, we can do more, frankly, better with our data presentation. And I know Roberta's got some neat ideas on that too.
I just have one other question on the data side. So we've heard that our public health nurse has been being utilized to collect all this data, which I know Commissioner Corrigan pointed out doesn't seem, and Carrie pointed this out as well, it's not the best use of a nurse's expertise and skill set to be doing that work of calling all the clinics and that sort of thing. I guess I would suspect that's also probably not the best use of an epidemiologist's expertise and time, you know, to be spending a lot of time collecting that data from clinics, et cetera. So I guess I'm just wondering what you're picturing in terms of overcoming that hurdle. Is it utilizing administrative staff for that? Is it setting up systems? Is it both? Kind of what are you thinking about how we move forward in making that process work a little bit better?
I think certainly from an administrative standpoint, you know, if there's errors in data and people are calling to clean that up, again, that's really more of an administrative role. And we've all, you know, we know HIPAA rules and we, you know, don't disclose that information. So, you know, making sure that everyone is attuned to that. And so that could be more of an administrative task. I know CDPHE is also coming out with maybe some electronic systems. I still need to dig into that a little bit better. We do have CEDARS, but I think there are some other software capabilities potentially that are being released through CDPHE. But, you know, I come from a background too of working with electronic medical records and seeing the amount of different papers and paper requisitions going on, you know, that again can lead to errors. So having someone, you know, that's sifting through that is very detail oriented and can pick up on those and get all that data in one place. Again, that's more of an administrative role, but then the epidemiologist would go and verify the data and make sure that everything is cleaned up appropriately.
So I guess just a comment, I know that you have probably in your last, have you been working 48 hours yet? I don't even know. haven't probably had the opportunity to fully evaluate the capacity of the department, but I guess I would just offer personally that, you know, we need to know whether there's enough administrative support within your department with just that one full-time person or whether there's more needed. So I would just put that out there.
Yeah, and I know the School of Public Health is also a good resource. They have some students that are available too if we needed someone like that to assist. And I was going to explore that as well as a potential resource.
But we still have an intern that's supposed to be helping us too. Is she on board?
Does anybody know anything about the intern?
Signed
a contract.
I recall doing that, but I think that's my last input into that process.
Okay, well, good. That's all right.
Okay, I'll admit it. I fooled y'all. I'm the intern.
We're paying you way too much for an intern, Dr. Merrington.
I think Carrie had stated that the intern was under her license, so the intern was going to be going to Moffitt County with her.
Well, that answers that question.
Okay. There we go.
I think it was a social work intern, which makes sense because I think Carrie has a master's in social work, but maybe we could just confirm because Route County did sign a contract with this person.
Well, the state of public health in Route County is not going to rise and fall upon the availability of this particular intern, I'm sure. I have just one more question before we move on to consideration of the amended public health order. And Dr. Harrington, I'm going to direct this at you, and this is at the risk of possibly asking you to speculate a little bit. And so I would preface this by saying, and you, as you have pointed out earlier, that we really do have quite a low incidence of disease within Route County right now, especially when we compare ourselves to some of our neighbors. I see that the 14-day 14 days between July 11th and July 24th, Eagle County reported 169 cases. In that same time frame, by my math, we've reported approximately 16 cases in those same 14 days. So there's obviously a part of me that would like to talk about how we as a community, Rob County, Steamboat, and the entire community can really take some credit for observing our public health order, state public health orders, the cooperation that we've gotten from our business community and the support from them. And we might even think about patting ourselves on the back a little bit for having done a good job to control the spread of the disease. But I will tell you that the pessimistic part of me says, we do not live on an island here on Route County. And when we look around the country and the increased disease prevalence regionally and nationally, do you think that we can continue to protect ourselves as a county and not be overwhelmed by what's happening nationally and regionally?
I would say yes, based on two general concepts. One is, I do believe that if people follow social distancing, wash their hands frequently, wear masks, if the majority of us do that for a bulk of the time, I have belief, and this is somewhat evidence-based, that that can keep the disease in check. I think that our efforts locally have been worthwhile, and I think our case count is not as bad as I thought we were going to be at this point. I mean, I'll be candid about that. I was worried that we would see much higher cases by now. I think that this, you know, I can't compare us very well to other places, although I do make note that some of the other counties with higher cases did open up more, if you want to use that phrase, bigger groups sooner and, you know, variance requests sooner and so forth. Is that part of the factor with them? Maybe, maybe not. There's a lot of different things that go into this. I think that our benefit has been that locally we've had great cooperation with our business community. I mean, we have our regular meetings. I know my impression has been that people want to do the right stuff and they understand the connection between keeping business going and taking care of the disease. I think that I'd like to think that our communication has been effective in our community, both with with Robin and our communication efforts from the county, but also with the local media. So I'd like to think that whether it be, you know, our rationale for mask wear and all that, that's been effective. I a month or two ago had the opinion that yes, localities could craft their own plan for this. It made some sense to me at the time. Disease rates are different in different places, needs, priorities, resources are different. So I understood this idea that letting different localities kind of go their own pace and do things differently. I now have backtracked on that. I think we've seen that as Florida goes, so goes Steamboat, so to speak. You know, we have cases of people who've been there and come back here and they're positive. And clearly, we had no cases here in the community from May until about June 8th. And then we started going up. And, you know, where did it come from? Well, it came from other places. Those other places are throughout our country. So we are connected to other places. So I don't discount that we can quite put a bubble up around this. But at the same hand, I would give credit to the efforts of our community to do the things that we think make a difference, because it appears that we have kept things moderately in check. I mean, I'm not going to say that we're as low as we need to be, but we're clearly not as high as I was worried we would be. And we have appeared to remain fairly stable throughout the month of July. So I have to believe that we are doing some things right in our county, and I would applaud everybody for their individual and organizational efforts to do so.
Thank you. Commissioners, Roberta, did you want to comment on any of that?
No, I agree with everything that Dr. Harrington has stated. And, you know, we just need to remain vigilant. You know, we're not out of the woods, and we need to limit our contact with others and wash those hands. I want to get a t-shirt that says wash your hands and just wear that around.
We can, I think we can find a place in the budget for you to get a t-shirt. Any other questions for public health before we move on to the discussion of the amended public health order?
So we could start something novel. We can have ball caps that say, wash your hands.
Math.
The little faucets sticking out kind of.
There you go.
I do have just a really, just a kind of a technical question. If you guys don't know the answer, maybe we could follow up. I meet with the Restaurant Association every Wednesday, and I just had a question from them about whether the outbreak at the Haven would impact our restaurant variants. I don't think it does at all, based on my understanding, but I told them that I would try to have an answer for them when I meet with them this afternoon. So I don't know who's the best person to answer that for me. And
well, yeah. I can start with it, but I think Roberta will want to add in on this too. You know, I mean, the metrics that they're using to state are based on total numbers. So regardless of whether it's in a long-term care facility or outside of it, that is our number. And I know that that is what they look at. I think the point to be made is, you know, that we make the case that those are somewhat qualified numbers when they're in a long-term care facility. We don't ignore it. They matter greatly to our community. They reflect the disease prevalence in our community. But we also, and I think the CDPHE understands as well, that those represent a particularly vulnerable population locality. And that's what we've seen around the state. 40%+ of the deaths in the state have been in long-term care facilities. So I know that they look at the whole numbers. It's just, I think that they can qualify that. And maybe that's a role we have too. Roberta?
Yes, totally agree. And, you know, in terms of the worker populations, you know, when we are looking at a long-term care facility, you know, those workers are unfortunately at higher risk there. So taking all of that into account is what we should be doing with all of our numbers. And, you know, I think if we saw more numbers as well in community spread, that would also be a concern that would maybe lead to some of our decisions around facilities and businesses and what we would want to do there as well.
And conceptually, the facilities, they have people moving in and out of our community. And while I've tended sometimes to segregate them a little bit, in both of these facilities now, roughly half of the positives are staff. So at Casey's Pond, that was the case there of the 20-some cases we had. And now at the Haven, we have 3 staff and 4 residents so far back. And those staff are moving in and out of that facility to the community. So even though we understand that they're a distinct entity, they're not disconnected from the community in which they reside. And to that point, it's relevant when we look at our overall counts.
All right. I think it is... probably time that we move on to consideration of the amended public health order. A question I have before we start, commissioners, on our agenda, it shows public comment kind of after the consideration of the amended public health order. Do you guys think it's appropriate that we would take public comment before we make a decision on extending the public health order?
I think you could take public comment on that specific item and then have general public comment following that.
I think we ought to have a presentation on the amended thing first.
And then have public comment and then move on to making a decision and then using after that time for any other public comment.
Yep, that's what I'd say. That sounds good.
Yeah, there may be folks who have comments that are separate from the order itself.
Okay, great. Just wanted to get that straight procedurally. All right, Eric, I think you're up to present the consideration of the amended public health order.
The existing public health order 03 concerning mitigation plan for all businesses is set to expire in 2 days And so this was put on your agenda for consideration of extending or a discussion to allow it to be rescinded automatically. The last time we talked about this public health order, the state had only voluntary orders in place in regards to face masks or face coverings. That's obviously the hot topic still. And so one of the discussions we've previously had, or this board has had, was whether to go ahead and allow this order to rescind and rely on the state's order, while others believe that it was still appropriate to maybe continue to have this order, although no decision was made until hopefully today in that regard. Linnea, you can chime in if you want. I think the state order currently is set to expire August 15th. So that's a relatively short time frame from now. It would be okay, in my opinion, if the county's order were duplicative of the state order or not. I mean, either way would work fine. As you know, the state's orders change oftentimes without any notice. And even though they may be duplicative, this would allow the county to have some stability and control on local public health orders. I also provided to you, so this would be the fourth amended public health order if approved. I've sent you a version in markup so that you can easily see the changes. What I did not mark up was the section dealing with face coverings, and I thought that would be the focus of our discussion today. So I did provide the board alternative languages, options, I should say, where face masks are concerned. And this was in consultation with Dr. Harrington. And I would recommend that you allow Dr. Harrington to address face coverings directly when you get to that point. So that's what's in front of you today. And I think there are probably also questions about the penalty section that is contained in section 10 of the public health order. That has not changed. That's been the same since the very outset, but I wanted to offer some comments on that because we, the county, have received a lot of feedback on that section seems heavy-handed and threatening and overt to some degree. My response to that would be that this section would be a requirement in a enforceable public health order. It provides notice of what the possible maximum penalties might be. As a former DA, I can tell you that it's very, very extremely rare that penalties like this that are set out by statute, not by choice, mind you, by statute, are enforced in this manner, but we are required to set out the maximum allowable penalties. Of course, we've had this discussion numerous times that the purpose of the public health order is not to cite people, jail people, or fine people. It's to attempt to gain compliance with what the Board of Health determines to be necessary protective measures. With that, I would go ahead, Tim, and turn it back to you if you had any specific questions or any direct discussion with the board, or if you wanted to go to public comment now.
Well, I think actually I'd like to hear from Dr. Harrington, get his input onto what his recommendations might be regarding this public health order.
And then can I ask a follow-up question to Eric just on the penalties topic?
Sure. Please.
Eric, just for clarification, I know I've received some questions, and I noted that the state, you know, has different penalties listed for their public health orders. Could you just clarify why that is? I understand that ours are based on the maximum penalties for violation of a county public health order, but I think that's just been a little bit confusing. I know also municipalities, when they've issued mask requirements, they've had slightly different penalties. Can you just clarify why there are differences?
cities and counties in the state are subject to different statutes and or ordinances in the case of a city. And so we use different statutes to enforce different orders. So the state has been citing a different statute altogether for the enforcement of its public health orders, but it also still cites the maximum penalties under that statute. I don't know why. They're different necessarily, at least between the state and the county. Other than the obvious, the statutes are different, but at some point I imagine the legislature considered that. And oftentimes what happens is when the legislature takes up the issues at different times, it's a different set of folks altogether making these decisions. And so apparently the maximum penalties citing a class one misdemeanor is just different for the county than it is for the state.
Thanks. That's my only question, Tim. Thank you.
Doug, anything for Eric before we move on to Dr. Harrington?
So, Eric, you touched on the 60 days as well as not 30 days, what we've been, did you touch on that?
I didn't. There was previous discussion about instead of bringing this to the Board of Health and having a lengthy discussion every 30 days, the potential of extending it out to a further time, giving us more time to, I guess, assess and discuss, but also not force us into a meeting like this every 30 days. The fact is that the order can be rescinded at any time. So if even next week, by some miracle, it was deemed that unnecessary to have this order, it could be rescinded at that time. I don't recommend having an open-ended order. We want to have a definite point in time where we either have to address it by extending it or allowing it to rescind.
I take it that answers.
Yep, thank you. That's great. Thank you.
Is your question? Dr. Harrington, we'd like to hear from you about this order.
Yes, yeah, so I'm going to focus on the section regarding mask wearing. Our current public health order has a blanket mask requirement that does not distinguish based on age. The governor's order and other guidance from states, such as school policies, suggest an age demarcation for when masks are required. And so I think our discussion today necessarily should focus on this age limit thing. So again, our current mask does not distinguish between, requirement does not distinguish between ages. Nationally, the CDC, American Academy of Family Physicians, American Academy of Pediatrics, and there's other referenced sources I can list, have discussed that wearing a mask for children under 2 years of age is not practical and not desirable. So that is one cutoff point that I would say is a somewhat constant discussion point in the medical and public health community is the 2 year cutoff point. Then we have our current state orders, which delineate a 10 year cutoff. The state mask requirement requires masks of all those above 10 years of age. Now, that's not to say that people under 10 years of age shouldn't or can't wear a mask. Part of the state's argument, the CDPHE's argument, was that the transmission of disease and the infection rate in individuals 10 and under is quite low. And therefore, they use that to justify their discussion of a 10-year demarcation point. I would comment that in Colorado, only 2.9% of the positive COVID cases have been documented in people under age 10. Similarly, in our county, we have had no positive cases in children under age 10. I do know that we have tested some. It's not been a scientific sampling. The youngest age that we have had in Rock County for a positive COVID test has been age 16. We have had a couple antibody tests reported that were positive as low as age 11. But there again, nothing under age 10. However, as I did mention, it is not without some prevalence in the underage 10 group. Also, we're well aware that there are infrequent but serious cases such as multisystem inflammatory syndrome, which we've had a couple deaths in Colorado with. So I don't want to discount that it cannot affect young people. This gets, though, into this bigger issue of we're worried about, there's two populations to be concerned about. There's the population of those who are 10 and under, and then there's the concern of all the rest of the population and what the risk is if those people under that age are not wearing masks. You know, those of us who take care of kids and in our medical clinics, we all know that come September, it's cold and flu season beginning. Now, that's partly a function of people spending more in time and so forth. But we all believe that one of the biggest factors is the beginning of school. When school begins, within a few weeks, we start to see respiratory illnesses in our community. And so it's well understood that schools are a major reservoir of illness in any community during the school year. So it's that to that kind of carries forward to the point of saying, well, yes, kids can promote and transfer illnesses. I think most of us who've been parents of kids know that when our kids are young, we get more colds and stuff because of them bringing it back to us. I would also highlight one important consideration too when we talk about these numbers of kids. Our testing data goes back to April into March, right? We close schools in March. Our testing data does not represent what happens when children are in school. It's possible that we will see more positive COVID cases. That's conjecture on my part. I will, on the other hand, also comment that there is international data that has been put forward to suggest that the infection rate and transmission from very young children, say under 10 years of age, is low. So it's not a clear-cut case in terms of saying yes or no, but I think some clear consideration points are some of the national guidelines that do talk about an age of 2 at least, below which we would not expect or want young people at that age to wear masks. And then we have the state CPHE guideline, which is age 10. That's not widely adopted around the U.S., but that is one that came out in our state orders. The beauty of an all-age thing is it's probably easier to enforce. It's going to be a little bit hard to determine who's 2 and who's 2 years and 1 month of age, or 10 and 10 months and one month of age, and so forth. I would also comment that our local schools are all considering this issue as they prepare to open for the fall. I think that all the schools are considering, and I expect that at least some of them will be instituting mask requirements for all their students, regardless of age, from preschool and kindergarten and up. So those are all factors to consider with this. I would comment in a general way that Commissioner Corgan's question earlier prompts me to kind of consider, yes, I think we've done pretty well in our community. I would attribute that to the fact that we are doing some things right, and therefore that would be an argument to say that we should continue what we're doing because it has been effective. That's the end of my comments at this point, pending your questions. And I might defer to Roberta too if she wants to add in on this.
No, I agree that there are some challenges with ages, and as you mentioned, Dr. Harrington, that, you know, how do you know when someone turns 11, you know, what's different, what's changed from them yesterday to their birthday today? And again, the concern at schools and being an occupational health nurse as well, you know, making sure that not only our teachers, but our communities protected all around.
Thank you. Commissioners, any more questions for public health or legal before I go to public comment?
I'm assuming from Dr. Harrington's comments that your recommendation is to continue this public health order, even in the places where it may be duplicative with the state order. Would you just speak to that and your reasoning for that?
Tenet of public health is public communication and creating an environment of healthy practices. to that degree, I've always believed that a key to learning for children or adults is repetition. The more times you hear something, the more it sinks in. I mean, that's a kind of a standard teaching thing. So that tenet would make an argument for the more modes and the more times that you're able to convey a message of, you know, public health activity, then the better that's adopted by your community and the more widespread it's used. So to that point, if we have our messaging on what we think is healthy practice during the COVID pandemic, that buttresses other messages out there from the state, from national levels and so forth. And it makes a consistent message. In public health, we're always concerned that we have a public message out there of what is healthy behavior. And we want that message to be consistent. When people see inconsistent messaging or lack of messaging at different levels, can undermine that. So again, it kind of plays this different modes, different levels, different times, giving the same message.
Great, thank you very much. I think I'm ready to move on to a public comment. So Kendra, if you wouldn't mind, would you please describe our process for making public comment to our attendees?
Yes, so the way public comment works is you raise your hand. We'll then select you, let you know when you've been selected to speak. So if you're on the computer, you would just click the raise your hand button at the bottom. If you're on the phone, you would press *9. And then remember also, if you're on the phone, you have to unmute your phone. And then you also have to press *6 to unmute your line through the Zoom connection.
All right. If anybody would like to make public comment, please raise your hand at this time. All right, I am not seeing, oh, well, I saw a hand go up and go down. Now I see another hand up. So I see Chief Tulzewski from Hayden, I believe. Is that you, Chief? And would you
care to hear? Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Just a observation and something we had discussions with here within town, with the schools struggling to try to maintain a very safe environment but yet open and get kids into classes, and then listening to Doc's comments about age and enforceability, might be worth, or might be, it's suggested, recommended, possibly consideration for your consideration of having a cutoff or a determination for masks within school and kids based on grade. Whereas where the younger ones, where that's going to be very challenging in the K and first grade, as kids get older, they are more in need of that protection. And we may want to consider that instead of tying it to an age group, which would also kind of eliminate, well, is this person 2 years old, two and a month, that type of thing. And we just wanted to bring that up for just consideration and also to make it easier on the school districts to be able to have an established policy. If your child is fourth grade, doesn't matter what age you are, that's the point, or third grade, or whatever point that gets picked up. At that point, you have to wear a mask. It might just be easier for everybody to manage as it moves through, and just wanted to put that out for the for consideration to the board. Thank you for the time.
Thank you, Chief. Thank you, Chief. Is there anybody else that would like to make public comment today? I am not seeing any raised hands, so I am going to close public comment at this time and go back to the commissioners for any further questions that they may have and comments before we potentially entertain a motion.
So yeah, I have a question back for Dr. Harrington, and whether you talked about it, you called me last night, we had a discussion about school boards, the school districts and the rest, and how, you know, and how this interacts or doesn't interact with the school districts opening and the rest, and the, you know, and again, it's all intricate, it's all in, it's all related, but it's kind of not maybe, and still we're not stepping on the school district's toes here to what they're doing as well. And just like to have you elaborate on that a little bit, if you could, Dr. Harrington.
Right. Well, the schools really have two populations. They've got the students, and you know, I talked about that a bit, and their risk level and maybe low transmission and so forth. But the schools are also populated with adults. And many of those adults also have their own vulnerabilities towards this virus. So for the safety of staff, the issue of mask wearing becomes perhaps even more relevant. And I think that's one of the issues that the schools are considering as they consider how they can open and how they can make their staff, their adults, feel safe in that environment. Obviously the schools can make their choices and are going to make their choices on what measures they do to mitigate the spread of disease. And that includes, to the point, what ages they want students to wear masks. They may very well, some of the schools may very well want to say that everybody in their school is going to wear masks. There is a dilemma of what do you do in fifth grade when half the kids are 10 and half the kids are 11. And so you're going to have half the kids in there wearing masks and half not. So to the comment, I think that they will be considering that kind of a problem when they decide if they do masks, how they're going to define who has to wear masks. I suspect that they will be strongly considering having all classes wear masks. And that's very reasonable. And, you know, the national bodies that I referenced earlier, some of them specific comment that even though under age two, they don't think people should wear masks, above age two and up to, you know, 10 or whatever, they still encourage it. And they think when possible. And I think most of us know that the young kids can possibly do that too. So the schools, I think the mask part's going to be a big part of their decision-making. And I know they're all considering that. And I think that they would be looking, I suspect that they're going to look at age or class ranges for masks rather than just a simple age cutoff because of the problem that we've mentioned that in some classes you could have some with and some without.
So if I could, I just want to follow up, I guess maybe a question to all of us, maybe not to Dr. Harrington, but, you know, so the schools are still subject to our business mitigation that's included in the order. And that means that they need to be signing in and having tracing and temperature checks or whatever on all their teachers as they come in and have some sign-in capability based on our business mitigation thing. So I'm just wanting to make sure that's, we all agree on that.
I know that schools are incorporating that too.
Yeah, thanks for your point, Doug. To that point, Dr. Harrington, I know that you have been communicating with the school districts, and I also know that the state directed school districts to work with their local public health on reopening plans. Can you just speak to the conversations that you and Carrie have had with our school districts in order to support them with those plans?
Yes, along the way with several of the local private and public school districts, we've brainstormed about ideas. Some of it has to do with what testing resources we'd be available to help them with. Some it's been about, again, just thinking through these issues. I've said before that, you know, there's no playbook, and so people need to be deliberate in what they're doing. They need to kind of mentally walk through the what ifs and what do we do when this occurs or whatever. And so all the school communities have been doing so for quite some time, and they are very consciously concerning these issues, whether it's mask wearing, it's hand washing, it's cohorting. If you have lodgers, you know, how are they going to be confined? So they're being very deliberate about this. And they've also had, I think, from what I've seen, some good direction given down from the state public health department, as well as the Independent School Association. So as much as any organizations in town, I feel confidence with them that they've had a lot of guidance and put a lot of effort into sorting this out. I think, though, there's still a lot of uncertainty as we get into the last few weeks because we're waiting on maybe even some further details from the state if possible. But also, I think everybody's kind of half holding their breath to see what the disease prevalence does. And if we have rising disease in the state, does the state do something different? If we had rising prevalence in our community, would we do something different for that as well? So that's the extent. Carrie, and I'm sure Roberta will be filling in that role too, having conversations with them. I have had conversations with several of the entities. In fact, it's a weekly process. So that's an ongoing activity.
And I would assume, to Doug's point, that it's an expectation that they all have processes in place to ensure that there are not staff members coming to school when they're sick.
Yes. Yes.
But the bottom line is that the school districts are subject to our public health order, and whatever threshold we choose as a age threshold, the school districts will be subject to. They could impose more stringent requirements, much like we have our relationship is with the state, but they will be subject to our public health order as a floor, so to speak.
That is my understanding, and that's kind of partly to the heart of why I think this is an important issue in terms of how we consider it with the schools, or that it that the schools do matter in our discussion with this transition.
Any more questions before we move on to making some comments and potentially a decision? So I'll start off with a couple of parameters, or maybe some of the simpler ones. Let's just talk about the expiration date of this public health order, which is, as it's currently written, is set to expire at the end of September. Are we comfortable with that as an expiration date rather than a 30-day timeline?
I'm comfortable with that. I don't have any other comments on that.
I'm also comfortable with that time frame.
So I'm going to vote against the ordinance anyhow. So I'm comfortable with 60 days, and I'm very comfortable that we can address this again if things change either up or down. And so I'm comfortable with 60 days too. So I appreciate the concept of not having to look at it in 30 days again as well. And I think we'll know more. And if we need to be more stringent in 30 days, we will do that, as well as if we need to be less stringent. I think, you know, as Eric said, that our attorney said, we can modify that as we move on.
Okay. And then seems that the next big issue is, it appears to me that the choice is in front of us, if we're going to move forward with this amended public health order, is whether we leave it as is, whether we adopt the state's 10-year old age limit, or if we potentially choose a 2-year-old age limit. I guess I'll ask Commissioner Melton to comment on this, considering the fact, Commissioner Monger, you've made it clear that you're not going to be supporting this amended public health order. So, I mean, you may have taken yourself out of the conversation just a little bit.
That's all right. So
I'm sure Doug would like to have an opportunity to comment on why he's not in support, but we can come back to that.
Sure.
I'm inclined to leave it as is, and I'll just state a couple reasons for that. I think it's prudent to have mask wearing for children as they go back to school. And I know there will be some parents who aren't comfortable with that. I would say, as the parent of a young child who is 4 and a half, I have observed him and his peers every day when I drop him off at daycare, and they do just fine with mask wearing. In fact, I would expect that schools would have significantly more issues with middle and high school students who are going to be required to wear masks under the state order, no matter what we do. You all know that I am a former teacher. I know that we've all received comments and concerns from teachers across the county, and I know this is happening across the country, about their safety when they go back to school. And as both a parent and a teacher, I can concur with what Dr. Harrington says, which is that when kids go back to school, everybody gets sick. The teachers get sick, the kids get sick, the parents get sick. And I would suspect this year, that's going to be a real issue. And whether it's COVID or not, When kids are sick, they're not going to be at school, period, which is not the typical practice. When teachers are sick, they're not going to be at school, which again, I think any of us can say that we have gone and taught in the classroom with a runny nose or a cough or whatever else. And I think to the extent we can limit the transmission of any viruses within the school environment, it's going to be a benefit to keeping the schools open and to keeping people safe and healthy. And I do have concerns about the question of, so regardless of what we decide today, anyone over the age of 10 is going to be required to wear a mask in Rowell County. That is a fact, based on the state orders. And, you know, I do really worry about, and this is for the school districts to worry about, but I would say that we enable them with some valuable tools when we say from a public health standpoint, from a health standpoint, we believe there's value in kids under 10 wearing masks and them not having to sort through, well, I have a class of fifth graders, and as soon as it's your 11th birthday, you have to put a mask on. I think that's a challenge for them. And I think we provide a lot of support for the school districts with consistency. And then finally, I would, in terms of the, just the public health order overall and not wanting to make a change. I think that it's working. I don't think that we are or are going to be storming into schools or grocery stores and pointing at kids and saying, you're 3, you have to wear a mask, or you're 11, you have to wear a mask. I think what we're doing is working, and I think it's being enforced. Well, our education efforts are revolving around the CDC recommendations. I don't think we've been out there. I don't think we have people thinking, oh, kids under 2 have to wear a mask. I think it's clear and it seems to work as is. And when you make a change, that's what people notice, is that something changed. And I think there's a lot of value in consistency, both for our businesses, for our residents, for our visitors. I think what we're doing is clearly working, and there's value in consistency. I suspect that as school reopens, we'll know whether this is important or not. I think there will be more research. We will see what happens in the schools, but I'd rather be more proactive and proceed cautiously as school reopens rather than removing protective measures we have in place and creating a more problematic environment. So those are my thoughts.
Thank you, Commissioner Melton. So I've got a couple of comments. Number one, I agree with most everything Commissioner Melton stated, especially in terms of consistency. I think that's really important. You know, I've been very, a little nervous about this issue of Rowell County Public Health, in essence, making decisions for school districts. There's, you know, a part of me as a former school board member that I would have liked to have been left alone in my own school district to make the decisions about what was best for my own school district. But I'm persuaded that thought does not outweigh the basic needs of public health across Rowell County. And I agree with Commissioner Melton's comments about this. And also Dr. Harrington's comments that it's not just the children's health that we're concerned about, but we have the health of staff members, not only teachers, but in all kinds of different settings around the county. So I'm not inclined to raise that age limit to 10 years old to match the governor's order. And then finally, talking about the success that we've had so far, I don't believe that this is a time for us to step back or take our foot off the gas. I think we're a ways away from having this disease contained, and we should keep doing what we've been doing. And the idea that the state order might potentially expire 15 days from now introduces that element of uncertainty that by virtue of our continuing our public health order does in fact provide that certainty and predictability, not only to the school districts, but to businesses and activities throughout the county. So Doug, I don't know if you want to make a comment now or if you want to wait till we get a motion on the table to make your comment.
I'll make my comments now. That's fine. We will talk about it later. So, you know, I support the business mitigation. I think that's been very successful. And, you know, what this whole thing is, we have a whole bunch of tools out here. It's not just the masks and it's not business mitigation. It's social distancing and personal responsibility is social distancing. So, yeah, I'm against the number one reason why I'm against this order is because it is duplicative of state. We've asked the state to come step up and do what they needed to do to, you know, and so we could have a balancing across county boundaries, across city boundaries and the rest. And so I'm against that because I think the state order is doing what we wanted to do. And I have said all along, I'm pretty well a non-regulatory kind of guy, and I hate being the mask police. I'm not very happy about being. And I'm against the county-wide concept of it. I've talked about it at the last meeting, as well as this meeting. I'm getting an exorbitant amount of pressure from my citizens in Hayden and West Route. And even though we now have Moffitt County is also under the mask order, we get a little more acceptance out of that. But, I think the mask rules have helped. I think personally, I'm supportive of the mask rules. I use them and I use the mask when I go out and I think it's the right thing to do. I'm against the mandatory part of that. You know, and businesses, we keep hearing from businesses, well, you know, your businesses had the right all along to exclude people that weren't going to wear masks. You could say no, and they're doing that now finally too. And, you know, they're finally taking their own responsibility of, you know, spreading the disease and as well to their customers as well as to their employees. So, you know, I guess, I'm just still, you know, I think there's a lot of personal responsibilities again. And, you know, we talked about, again, the county-wide versus, you know, the elephant in the room here is the city of Steamboat Springs. And as Dr. Harrington said, as Florida goes, Route County goes, well, it isn't really so much Route County, it's what Steamboat's doing and the tourists that are coming into our community. And that we have to have those people. I understand that. But, you know, I'm just against the countywide thing and I'm against the duplicative order of the, I think that does cause further confusion. So those are my positions on it. I support the masks myself and I support definitely the business mitigation part of this thing. And I think that's really has helped and worked.
Thank you. Commissioner Melton, are you prepared to make a motion?
I am. I'm wondering, would you mind if I just address one other question to Dr. Harrington?
No, that's fine. Go ahead.
Dr. Harrington, this question, which Commissioner Monger raised, and I'm sorry, I forgot to ask it earlier, about just the differences between Steamboat and our other areas of the county. Has come up in comments that we've received over the last few days and couple of months. And I know we haven't publicly shared a lot of information, and I'm not really aware of the information, what the information shows in terms of where our cases are occurring and kind of are there different things happening in different parts of the county. I wonder if you could just let us know what you've seen on the data side of things with regards to that specific question.
Yeah, and I wish I could give you the percentages in terms of whether they're more or less in different communities within our county. Clearly the bulk of cases that we have do have a Steamboat residence, but we've had throughout all this numerous cases in all the communities. We've had cases in North Route, we've had cases in South Route, Oak Creek, Hayden. So clearly the disease has been spread all around. Just in the last 2 weeks in our cases. I'm trying to think. I think we've had two or three from Hayden. In fact, Hayden does crop up. You know, in terms of where, though, we're getting the disease, I would say that we've had more cases of community spread, meeting cases in Steamboat where we don't know where they came from, which might reflect people bringing it into the community. A lot of our cases with travel, we've identified people who traveled to other states and brought it back, and we've seen that in all our communities. I can't directly measure how much disease influence in our various communities is direct, you know, is tied to the influx of people visiting. And I guess I would just summarize it by saying that we see cases throughout our county in all the communities. And recently, it's not just been Steamboat, although Steamboat does take up the predominance amount of the cases that we see in Route County.
Okay, thank you. I would also point out that 50% of the people in Route County also live in Steamboat Springs. So, okay, thank you for that follow-up. Sorry, let me pull this up. Mr. Chairman, I would move to approve the extension of Public Health Order 2020-03, which requires mitigation plans of all businesses. And that extension will be until September 30th of 2020. With no amendments to the current other order other than the expiration date.
Second.
Yeah, I was going to second. That's fine.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any more discussion?
So I just had one other comment. I just keeps popping up in my mind. Masks are not the silver bullet, and they're not the ultimate, and they're not the... So it's all those other things and all the tools and the tool chest that really need to help us. So I want to remind people that if you're wearing a mask, that doesn't mean you need to be up and shoulder to shoulder with your buddy. So
thank you for that, Doug. Any more discussion?
I'll just make a comment. We have really seen, as was addressed earlier, that Route County is in a really different place than a lot of the counties that have a significant amount of tourism. We have, knock on wood, seemed to be able to keep a lid on this much better, I think, than a lot of our neighbors, and I really do believe it's because of these measures we put in place. And to Commissioner Monger's point, while masks have been the talking point for a lot of folks, they are certainly not the only tool, and all of the tools contained within this public health order for reducing spread and mitigating the risk of this virus in our community are critical. There's social distancing requirements. There are requirements for health screenings, in addition to the face covering requirement. And I think, and I'll just acknowledge Roberta's point about hand washing. All of these things are critical measures, and in addition to the testing and the contact tracing that we continue to engage in. And so just want to really encourage our community to stay vigilant and keep up these things. And I know that we all have been committed to making sure that that happens and that this public health order is just one tool in that. In reality, it's education, and it's everybody taking responsibility for doing these things. So fully supportive of Route County staying in the good position we're in and continuing these important efforts.
So we've asked a lot of our citizens over the last 5 months. And I don't think that I don't know what many of us thought back in March when we first declared a state of emergency. I don't know if we thought we would get through it in 2 or 3 months and things would start to get better. But it's become apparent that we are in this for the long haul. And I don't believe that 2 or 3 months from now we'll be out of the woods either. I think there's a lot that needs to happen. But yeah, I just want to acknowledge the efforts of our citizens and our businesses again. You know, Doug talks a lot about personal responsibility, and I do not disagree with him at all. And I do think that in addition to our public health orders, folks in Rouse County have taken on a lot of personal responsibility to do the right things. And so, yeah, I just wanted to acknowledge the efforts of everybody here. Having said that, if there's no further discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Aye.
Very good. thank you very much, Roberta and Dr. Harrington, and everybody that attended the meeting today. We appreciate it. And I guess I do have the second opportunity for public comment before we move on to our...
I think Commissioner Monger wants to make a public comment.
No, I don't want to make a public comment. I guess before we leave the COVID discussion, I'd like to ask and see kind of what we think and feel about what's going to happen on testing. I mean, everybody's frustrated with testing. And so, I mean, the state's frustrated with testing. The country's frustrated with testing. We're frustrated with testing. Our citizens are frustrated with testing. And it's so integral that, and I don't know what we, how we need to, how and who we need to lobby to figure out how we can get something. That is the tool that we need. That's the tool that we need to get moving here. And we talked about it last week, and the 7 days, 14 day lag time and whatever. And I realize that's not you, that's not us. And but we need to figure out how we can start lobbying some people with some bigger checkbooks and bigger things to figure out how we can move forward. So I don't know if Dr. Harrington or Roberta, if you have any comments on that, I'd like to hear that in the public that's on the on would like to hear maybe what your thoughts might be on that too.
Yes.
Go ahead, Roberta. You go first.
Sure. And, you know, I think about this a lot, and I understand that frustration with testing. One thing that we do have to remember is we just discovered this virus a couple months ago, like 7 months ago. And, you know, the ability to get testing has been a challenge with, you know, FDA getting something that's validated. I think even we see that with some of our antibody tests, you know, just some of the sensitivity and specificity issues that we're having with that. And, you know, developing all of these new tools, you know, is challenging in this time, and understanding what reagents, what different products that you need, you know, vials, all the collection mechanisms, those are all under strain. And, you know, I think everyone, it's just not unique to Colorado. It's not unique to Rouse County, as you mentioned, Commissioner Monger, that yes, this is a challenge. And, you know, just to maybe not add something else into that, but, you know, as we potentially see vaccines becoming available, you know, we might run into some similar issues with supply and availability. So we need to also be aware of those situations as well. So.
Yeah, I mean, I first should give some credit to the labs, all the commercial and state labs. I mean, back in April, they were doing 100 a day. Now they're doing thousands a day. So they're doing more than they used to. But in my estimation, and I'm probably not fully informed on this, but in my estimation, though, we don't have a well enough organized national distribution system for the reagent for the PCR test, for example. And so while we've seen the rush to test in these hotspot states, that's sucked up the supplies from states like Colorado to some degree. And it is quite literally a little bit of a marketplace out there, as I understand it. And so to that point, there could be a benefit if we, I think, as you suggested, if we could be part of some bigger coalition But then the diagnostic PCR test is still a highly complex test that is by regulation only allowed to be doing in highly complex labs, which is typically going to be a hospital. That's why only our hospital here in our community can do those. So we're a little bit limited on bringing those into any other clinical facilities around here. I had hoped by now that we would have true point of care testing. And while there is point of care testing available in the US, it's not very good. It has not been widely used because its sensitivity is very low. But I am going to relook into that a little bit for options for us, just because we've got to come up with some different pathways. The other good news pathway, though, is that now I think all the commercial labs have pretty much been approved to do pool testing. And the idea there is that you might have 10 people who have swabs collected. They're part of the material from each of those swabs is run as a single test. If that test is negative, then all 10 are negative. If that test is positive, they then go back to test those 10 individually with the same sample that they have. That could maybe reduce the demand a little bit on reagents. So I think that's going to become perhaps the standard for the labs as they run this. I'm worried as we get into the fall that we're not meeting the mark now. And when we have increasing demand in the fall with colds and fevers and all that, it's become even more challenging. So this is a problem. It's one I'm sorry that we're still dealing with, because I thought by now we'd be in a better situation. Testing is key. And we currently cannot meet the mark with our test results being a week out. I mean, it gets to be a little bit, borders on laughable when somebody's had symptoms for a couple days. They get a test done, get the result back 7 days, and voila, we give them an isolation order for 1 day because that's the remainder of their 10-day isolation period. Meanwhile, we've missed those 7 days to track out their contacts and further spread of it. Our surveillance testing really depends. You know, we're surveilling groups around here to find cases, but boy, it undermines the benefit of that if we're getting results back a week later too. I'm frustrated by this situation, as I think we know most people around the country are. And so it's a problem that we need to find an answer for.
I think follow up just to Doug's question, and maybe you don't have any answers right this minute. And Doug, I know CCAT for sure is talking about this. I'm not sure how much CCI has been discussing it, but, you know, what are the options in terms of who we need to advocate to? And I get it, everybody is in this same situation, but it's also kind of since the beginning, quite frankly, this has been a little each county for themselves. And so, you know, who is it that could have influence on this process, and what are our options in terms of trying to push back a few things, push back on this, identify innovative or regional types of strategies that could address the issue. So I think we need to keep talking about it. And I think Commissioner Monger is saying what I would say, which is I'm not comfortable with us just saying, well, there's nothing we can do. I think we have to keep doing pushing and figuring out what we can do so that our community can stay safe.
Yeah, I think we need to keep pushing for sure and let everybody know, or let, you know, and I'm not making excuses for what we're doing. That is reality. So we're doing as good as we can do, and that's reality. But the bottom line is up the food chain, we need to make sure that everybody knows that we're needing some more help. Everybody's needing some more help, and we need to collaborate and come up with some more push on some. I mean, if we can, you know, do the things that we can do as a nation and the rest, or even as a state, in a small amount of time, somebody's doesn't have it on their priority list high enough. So,
yeah, I guess my comment would be, again, we all really like the idea of local control and local solutions to local problems, but the reality is we have a national problem that really is crying out for national leadership and national resources that will serve all of us. I see that there's one person at least that has their hand raised. It's telephone number 678, and I've lost the rest of the number, but that individual that has their hand raised, you've been allowed to talk. Would you please go ahead and identify yourself?
Hi, my name's Ken Malden.
Hi, Ken. Go ahead.
Thank you. I reserved my comment, actually. I was anticipating that there would be an opportunity for public comment in response to the commissioner's deliberations before there was a vote called. So though I have comments I'd like to make, that my comments are moot at this point because the vote's already been called before voters have an opportunity to respond to the deliberations.
Actually, Ken, I think we did have that opportunity, but go ahead.
Okay, well, I just want to point out that I think we all recognize that it takes 30 days to create a habit, and that everyone in this community had 30 days of legitimate fear in the beginning of this when all we had were the models and forecasts that never came true. But that experience, I'm concerned, allowed us all to create a habit of fear. And I think that beyond developing the habit of fear, that we've actually created an environment where fear is considered a virtue, and where the more afraid someone is, the better of a person they are perceived to be. And I say this from the experience of having 18 consecutive days out of the valley this summer, where our family visited 13 states, we traveled 5,000 miles, and we had the opportunity to look at local data, the different communities we were staying. I talked to people in gas stations, restaurants, hotels, national parks all over the country, and comparing the results of our communities with those communities, I observed that we're all pretty much having a similar experience with this, regardless of the severity of the modifications that are put in place. That we observed that people are naturally self-distancing everywhere, but we also observed that where people had the individual decision to wear a mask, that the overwhelming majority of people weren't wearing masks where they weren't required. They were just self-distancing. And I could say that it's for the same general results that we're having. So I understand that what started off as good intentions and that we were all disinfecting groceries in April, but I think very few people are disinfecting groceries now. That the information has changed and our decisions and our risk assessment has changed. So my observation has been that we have much more onerous restrictions here than the communities that I visited across the country this summer, but we're not getting any better results. So I think we got to be open-minded that we could be doing more harm than good by focusing on fear. And that's concerning. I think that though the vote's already been taken, I wish that you would have relaxed the mask restriction, that I wish that you would allow the churches to open and allow people to self-distance and make those own decisions in consideration of the results are about the same, that I don't know that there's any gains for the additional modifications that we're doing. And I just wanted to share that experience and hope that any consideration you could give that would be applied.
Thank you, Ken. Is there anybody else that would care to make public comment? You need to raise your hand. Or is it *9 if you're on the phone? Or *9 if you're on the phone in order to raise your hand. I am not seeing any more raised hands, so I'm going to close public comment at this time. And we can move on to the balance of our agenda, which is our daily COVID-19 work session. I can't, Dr. Harrington? No, you're saying goodbye. Okay, very good. Roberta, you're doing good. You can go back to work now if you need to.
All right, thank you.
We'll see you a little later. Mark, do you have anything for us today?
Nothing further, Tim.
Robin.
Yeah, I just wanted to let you know, I can't remember if I said this yesterday, that the public survey is up. So if you go to the website, you can take the survey. So I urge everybody on the call to take the public survey, and it closes on August 19th. And so I will give you an update on the results, and we'll have a dashboard on the results as well as we get more comments. So just wanted to remind you about that. Thank you.
Great. I took the survey yesterday.
Great.
There's at least one response.
I did as well last night. Yep.
Oh, two then.
Yeah. We'll have it skewed. Just need the three of us right now. Just kidding.
It seems like we discussed quite a lot of COVID-19 related issues, even including county staffing. I'm struggling to think if there's anything else that we need to address today.
I didn't want to get into the weeds of the health educator positions in the middle of our Board of Health meeting, but I'm sure that's on the, Mark, I assume Roberta is aware of the situation with that and will be making her recommendations at some point.
Beth, she absolutely is. And again, I didn't touch on this specifically, but let me maybe take a minute to do so. One of the things that we wanted to include in Roberta's scan, environmental scan, if you will, and prioritization is to look at those health educator positions. And with the fact that we've got seven people from Steamboat Springs that are stepping forward, we want to be sure that we feel like that is going to be the right people to go ahead and put on board. And augment what we've got as far as some community volunteers stepping forward. And again, I say community volunteers, but as we discussed before, the Steamboat Springs employees are being paid, and they're even being paid if they're going into any kind of an overtime situation. So we want to see as those individuals get deployed, as we use them as a very important resource, we want to then go ahead and assess whether we feel the health educator is important at this time.
Thanks. And then previously you had asked me if I would be involved in the interview process for epidemiologist. I just, someone just keep me in the loop on whether you still want me to do that or not. I don't know if it's necessary. I don't have an opinion one way or the other, but I'm happy to do whatever you and Roberta think is needed on that.
Beth, we appreciate that. And you know, you've got a good baseline of experience that really helps to have you on that interview committee. And then, as we probably know, Dr. Harrington has also agreed to go ahead and be involved in those interviews.
Okay. This is not COVID-19. I wanted to follow up on that YVRA invoice. Did you see what was there? I knew when we talked about cutting the possibility of cutting the commissioner's discretionary fund, I knew we had already committed $5,000 of it, and I couldn't remember what it was for. And I think this is it. But do you guys have any recollection of that?
I recall that we were participating in this program, but the details escaped me. But Kendra has a look on her face like she may have some information to provide.
No, I'm the one that was asking the question. The airport said that the commissioners decided to pay for it out of the general fund, but I didn't know where in the general fund it was going to go, if that was decided it was a BCC budget item or if it was going to be under a different department. I wasn't sure.
So I think that, you know, again, this whole thing, not that it was confusing when we got it. Oh, we have one grant, two grants, or maybe we, who knows what we got. And you need how much money for us for something that we really don't know what we're getting. And so, yeah, that was a great experience. And so, but I think we did say that we were going to take it out of that 5,000. We were not, the airport was not going to get tasked with both $5,000 contributions. And that I think that we left some money in our discretionary fund. That was going to be a big part of it right there. So I think we had said that we would take it out of the commissioner's discretionary line item for the year.
All right. Thank you.
Word that works for me.
Because I think we decided not to cut that discretionary line item down to zero because we thought, you know, we might need some money to do some things in the COVID world here. So my recollection.
Yes, and we did commit this before the budget cuts, and it's the county's contribution to the match for the grant for solar. I sort of vaguely remember this, and I do feel gratified that I remembered we had committed some of that money, and I'll sleep better at night remembering what it was.
Well, bottom line is we we committed to making that payment. It's just a question of where it comes from. And I'm comfortable with it coming out of the discretionary, presuming that there's that much money in there.
I can't remember we've spent any money out of there yet this year. So we've all been stuck in our seat.
I think just small things, nothing major.
Well, we certainly haven't put much of a dent in our travel budget.
Yeah, the money is definitely available from that fund.
Okay, great. Thank you, Kendra.
Thank you.
Anything else for today's discussion? Beth, we've got the CCAT Tourism Committee this afternoon. I'll be able to join that for 30 minutes, but then I have a 4 o'clock meeting I need to go to.
That sounds good. Side note that the CCAT governing board is working on drafting a response to regarding the information from those CPR stories. I don't know if you guys ended up reading those, but
absolutely. That'll be great. I love those. Were great stories.
Well, I don't know if you saw, I just forwarded you the comment from the governor about how local governments need to step up and take more responsibility. Well, that was his response.
Remind him of where the CARES money went, you know?
I know. So anyway, I think that draft statement will come to the whole membership for approval, but I've been in the loop on that. People are pretty irritated.
It was interesting that one of the CDPHE people that was on the elite board became on the Oil and Gas Commission. So, that's good. Yeah. I love that part too.
Kevin McGowan. Who knows?
All right. Do we have anything else?
I have a question, please, for Mark, unrelated to the discussion, so I apologize. Where would you like me to call you after this meeting concludes?
Eric, thanks. I was going to call you, but why don't you just go ahead and call me on my cell phone, and we'll go from there. Thanks very much.
I'm not sure I have your cell phone.
Then I have yours, so I'll call you.
Very wise. Thank you.
All right. I don't believe we have any more business to conduct today. So let's go ahead and adjourn, and we will see you tomorrow.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Very good.